announce the three cases that will be argued and then call the first case. Excuse me, counsel, if you would give us a chance.
The following cases are scheduled for argument this morning, Wednesday, June 7th, 2017. 163498, Southern District of Iowa, United States versus Jason Springer. 163695, Southern District of Iowa, United States versus Rick Makonik. 163389, District of Nebraska, Kirk Vester versus Daniel Halleck. And 163238, District of Minnesota, United States versus Rex Furman. The first cases for argument are 163498 and 163695, United States versus Jason Springer and Rick Makonik.
Thank you, Ms. Michaels. Now, counsel, you may approach and good morning. You may proceed.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, I'm Judith O'Donohue, and I represent my clients who are present, Mr. Makonik and Mr. Springer, on a case that has been appealed from conviction for a violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1344, subsection 1, the bank fraud statute. The first issue that I wanted to address is what is actually being charged as the scheme to defraud a financial institution. And I think that if you look at the indictment and the instructions, it appears that the scheme is filing a false HUD 1 settlement statement. But I think if you look at the evidence that was presented at the time of trial, it looked to me like the government was trying to prove that the individual mortgage holders or their servicers could have obtained more money and should have been advised by the defendants, one or more of the defendants, that there was a resale in the wings that was for more money. I don't think that was charged, and I'm going to try to address my jurisdictional arguments just to this settlement statement because I think that's all that was charged.
It sounds to me like you're making a variance argument. I don't recall there being a variance argument in the brief.
It was issued too. In the brief, there was a variance argument. Yep. And I did make a variance argument, and I'm starting out my discussion with that because I think you have to know what the scheme is.
The jury was asked with respect to, was it 8 counts, is that right?
One count was withdrawn. So it was actually 8 counts, but only 7 counts.
It was essentially a special interrogatory on whether there was a false HUD-1 statement.
Yes.
Generated, isn't that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And but the scheme and the indictment alleged a number of means that were resorted to result ultimately in this alleged false HUD-1 statement, isn't that right?
Well, you know, I didn't interpret it that way because we're looking at two defendants. We're looking at an attorney who is a closing attorney and trying to close the A to B transactions. And then we're looking at a realtor who signed one affidavit with respect to one particular transaction.
Right. Yeah. I'm sorry, how do you say the gentleman's name?
Makonik.
He was charged with only one count.
Right.
And it's not clear to me that he was he didn't submit any kind of HUD-1 statement.
No, he didn't. What's more is there's no proof that he ever saw it.
There was a false affidavit that led to such a thing, and so he was aiding and abetting in the production of false. Was that the theory?
Well, I think that had to be the theory. I don't think it was proved clearly.
Was it argued to the jury that way?
Not really. That's a very interesting question, Your Honor. I appreciate that. What was actually argued to the jury, and this is why, since I wasn't trial counsel, I found the whole case a bit confusing, is that they lied. So everything was they lied, they lied, they lied. And they didn't really try to tie it up with a potential for loss to the bank or any particular intent with respect to getting something of value.
Forget about the loss matter. That's a different, if you will, for just a
yes,
minute.
Yes, sir.
I don't mean to interrupt, but
yep.
I'm interested in this question of how exactly this gentleman's case was segregated or differentiated for the jury in the closing arguments. Was there a government directed argument with respect to this, and asserted some kind of aiding and abetting argument or not?
Well, that wasn't. Let me back up. Aiding and abetting was submitted in the jury instructions, but the way the closing argument was framed, it was just that it was a lie. Okay. That he lied because he said that, you know, they had made some improvements, and that's going to justify the fact that there's no affidavit. Profit on the second sale.
That was the content of the affidavit that they pointed to?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, anyway, and perhaps because I wasn't trial counsel, I found it extremely confusing, but I think to make the legal arguments, it's necessary to kind of focus on the HUD 1. And I don't think aiding and abetting on the HUD 1 has anything to do with Mr. Makahuniak. He never saw it. He never was told about it. He didn't sign it. He wasn't at the closing. The only relevance as far as Mr. Makahuniak was concerned is that the one individual who testified for the servicer, GMAC, who had some personal knowledge, said that she wouldn't have gone ahead without the affidavit with the closing. However, the affidavit wasn't required by the owner of the mortgage, which was FHA, and they had already foreclosed. GMAC had already foreclosed on the mortgage, so they had an option to sell it at a sheriff's sale if that's what they wanted to do. And they didn't go forward with it. So my suggestion is that, you know, there isn't really any proof that without that affidavit they wouldn't have gone forward because they didn't want to sell it at a sheriff's sale, and they thought the $57,600 that they got for it was better than they would get at the sheriff's sale. So, I mean, I don't think there's really been any proof that, you know, the bank or we are, that's a whole other issue, the GMAC wouldn't have gone through with it without that affidavit except for a statement made by the lady, not required by HUD. So,
but if they know there was a willing buyer out there willing to pay more.
Now, that's a very interesting question, and I appreciate it. They aren't buying the same thing. The second, people closing on the second are buying things that have been somewhat fixed up, cleared up, with a guarantee that, you know, there's not going to be any mortgages or other liens. A lot of these properties had second mortgages or judgment liens or delinquent taxes. These all had to be cleared up by someone, and they were in this case cleared up by the trust through the efforts of Mr. Springer. So I don't think it's the same thing, and I don't think that the government even tried to say it's the same piece of property. You know, this was a difficult time for people looking to buy real estate. Because, you know, mortgages turned over from one person to another person to another person on a short sale. They were always throwing in these various requirements for a short sale. A lot of buyers wouldn't, if they knew it was a short sale, they'd say, forget it. I'm not even going to try to do an offer on it. It's too problematic. We'll have to wait 6 months, and we may, at the end of the line, not get it. People usually want to buy a house. So, no, I don't think it was the same piece of property. Now, I'd like to revert back to my jurisdiction argument. I do think that the government made some effort to prove that the institution that received the HUD-1 was an FDIC institution, but I don't think they quite got there. And the problem is, I think the best evidence in this case of who the mortgage holder was is who was foreclosed. Who was the entity that was named in the foreclosure petition that were pending at the time of these sales? Not some statement, very broad statement, made by a witness regarding it. So, for example, in First Avenue, the witness, Ms. Zener, indicated that it was Wells Fargo. But, in fact, there was a pending foreclosure action, and it was brought in the name of Wells Fargo Financial Iowa 3, Inc., and, you know, this, I could go on for every single transaction. The people that were testifying, except for Ms. Bonowitz, had no personal knowledge, and they didn't know what entity actually owned the mortgage. And I don't think that's going to be sufficient to prove jurisdiction here. If you look at the cases that have been cited.
Is it jurisdiction or just an element of the offense?
They're, thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. That's a good question. I think they're both. And that, for that reason, I think I can raise it at any level. It didn't have to be raised in particular at the trial court level.
I have a problem with the GMAC chain of title as well. I don't know who it is that's supposed to be the mortgage lender or the FDIC insured person.
Yeah, I know that is a bit confusing. I think with respect
to... Was there a motion for a directed verdict on this?
There was, made by Mr. Whalen, who is the public defender for Mr. Makahuniak. But to be fair to the government switched the argument from the FDIC to that it was a mortgage lending institution or corporation, I guess it was. And that I found very...
The problem with the elements of the offense, right?
Well,
that's your argument.
My argument is that they didn't prove it was a mortgage lending business either. And at the time of the directed verdict, the government pointed to the testimony of Mr. Martin from HUD. But if you review his testimony, he really didn't say a whole lot. He said that GMAC was an approved lender by FHA on their list, and they made lots of loans, and they were in various states. I don't think that rises to the level of the requirement that it's affecting interstate commerce. You know, I looked at U.S. v. Jones, which I didn't cite in my brief, and I think there was a similar Eighth Circuit case where I think you have to show something more than just that they did business in a variety of states. I don't think that equals activities affecting interstate commerce.
And one of the difficulties I have with the record is I'm not clear that what's the difference between GMAC and GMAC Mortgage and GMAC Mortgage LLC. Are we supposed to assume they're the same?
We are, and I think if you look at U.S. v. Alexander, I think the court decided you cannot do that.
Alexander, right?
Yeah. Thank you. I had reserved 10 minutes, so I have to quit the podium. Thank you very much for your attention.
Very well. Mm-hmm. We'll hear from the government. Mr. Kirkbaum.
Good morning. May it please the court. This appeal raises a host of issues, most of which were not raised in any form at the trial. But in any event, having raised them on appeal, none of them have merit. And I will start with the aiding and abetting theory with respect to Mr. Makahuniak. Judge Arnold, the government did indeed argue the aiding and abetting theory at trial. We argued it quite clearly, and the theory was this. It's found on page 1317 of the transcript. That's the portion of our closing argument where we address this. The argument was that Mr. Makahuniak aided and abetted the execution of this scheme by signing this false affidavit. It was an anti-flipping affidavit, and the affidavit said that there was no agreement currently in place to resell the house at a higher price. There explicitly was such an agreement currently in place, so that affidavit was simply false. There was an agreement to buy the house for $65,000.
He knew that. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry.
And there was evidence that he knew that.
I think there was powerful evidence that he knew it because he was the realtor for both transactions. So, in other words, he was the realtor on the transaction in which Nate Smith bought it for $65,000, and then he was the realtor the same day for the second transaction in which he sold it for $86,000. So there's no question that he knew that affidavit was false. And the signing of that affidavit was necessary to the execution of this scheme because it was necessary to the closing of the short sale transaction. The representative from GMAC testified that affidavit was an absolute requirement for the short sale to go through. So Mr. Makahuniak took a step that was necessary to the ultimate execution of the scheme and thereby aided and abetted the scheme. That was what we argued, and that's what the evidence showed.
Okay, well, since you mentioned GMAC, I've been looking through the record. It's hard for me to tell whether the theory was that the false statements were made to GMAC or GMAC Mortgage or GMAC Mortgage LLC, or if they're all the same, or if there was evidence they were the same.
They were treated the same by both parties at trial, Your Honor. The government called a witness from GMAC Mortgage, and that witness testified about GMAC. But further, the government heard testimony from an official with HUD about this same company. And there was only one.
What about U.S. against Alexander?
Well, I think Alexander is a different case for a couple of reasons. One is that in Alexander, the government only had a stipulation. And so there's a stipulation that Bank of America is insured by the FDIC. Alexander was a false statement to a bank case. So there's a piece of paper where the false statement occurred, and that piece of paper says Bank of America N.A. And so the question in Alexander is Bank of America the same as Bank of America N.A.? Well, we don't have a single piece of paper here. We have a larger scheme involving a number of falsehoods.
But you've got to identify someone to whom the false statement was made before the offense is made out, right?
And we did. We identified GMAC Mortgage in the indictment. The jury was instructed that they had to find that the false statement was made to GMAC Mortgage. The jury was instructed that they had to find that GMAC Mortgage was a mortgage lending business. And the witnesses referred to GMAC by shorthand at trial as GMAC, which is not unusual to not use the full name of an entity.
But there are a lot of these names floating around here. I think it's probably the better part of caution to make sure that the same collection of words is used throughout the testimony, because otherwise the thing begins to go off in different directions.
I take the court's point. I think that becomes clear when this issue is raised for the first time on appeal.
Yeah.
And I would further point out that in the end, there was no argument at trial that we had multiple entities. Indeed, Mr. McAhonick's attorney got up in his closing statement and said, we're not really seriously fighting in this case about whether or not GMAC was a mortgage lending institution.
So this would be plain error at best is what you're saying.
Yes, and that, so just to get the record site, that's in the transcript at page 1342 and 1343. And to be clear, the evidence from the HUD witness was that GMAC was a lender, that it made hundreds if not thousands of mortgage loans that were approved by the FHA, and that it made those loans in states across the country. That is more than sufficient to show that it is a mortgage lending business. There was no contention in the end that there was some other entity that belonged to this transaction. And I think that's true more generally for all of these transactions. Indeed, it was part of the defense in this case. All of the other institutions were FDIC insured, so GMAC is the only mortgage lending business. And part of the defense strategy was that these were large, sophisticated, national, big FDIC insured banks, and they were big boys. And they could make their own decisions about whether these short sales were a good idea, and they weren't really defrauded by these little guys in Des Moines. That was the defense theory. And so not only did the defense not challenge this issue, but there was a joinder of the parties on this issue that we were.
So there was no motion for judgment of acquittal on this basis?
Mr. McAhonick's lawyer did make a Rule 29 motion at the conclusion of the government's case. Then in his closing, that was denied. Then in his closing, he conceded the point.
He did raise it on this basis.
He did. He did, Your Honor. And then got up at closing and said that we're not disputing that GMAC is a mortgage lending business, which implicitly includes the concession that GMAC is the right entity here. That's the only entity the parties discussed.
What was the defense theory at trial, that these two people, defendants, were just bit players, played cameo roles in this whole thing?
That was part of the theory, that these banks bargained for, you know, made independent economic assessments about whether these transactions were a good idea and decided that they were, so they were not harmed or defrauded. That was a common theme from particularly from Mr. Springer. And Mr. McAhonick had a number of arguments, most of which I think, frankly, he's abandoned on appeal. One of his arguments was that the affidavit he signed was literally true. That was not supported by the evidence, but in any case, he does not appear to be pressing it today.
Didn't the witnesses generally testify in each instance that the FDIC insured entity that was involved was the one that was going to lose money?
Yes. So in each case, we had representatives from these banks saying that the bank was either the holder of this mortgage or the servicer of the mortgage, that the bank approved the short sale, and that the bank lost money on the short sale. Or in the case of those banks that were merely servicing these loans, we specifically asked those banks, did their institution face the risk of loss as a result of these?
But did you make the link that the institution that was going to make the loss was the one that was FDIC insured?
Yes. So
in each instance?
Yes. So there were two alternatives. One alternative was that the institution owned the mortgage, in which case all of those witnesses testified that they lost money on these short sales. Although we don't think that they had to lose money in order to show
us. When you say institution, you mean the FDIC insured institution.
Yes, right? And maybe if I could just briefly go through each count, it might be helpful to the court. So count one involved Wells Fargo, and the jury heard testimony from a Wells Fargo representative who said that Wells Fargo was insured by the FDIC, that Wells Fargo was the investor who owned this mortgage, that Wells Fargo approved the short sale, and that Wells Fargo is the institution that lost money in the short sale. None of that was contested at trial, ever. And the jury was entitled to credit it. Count two involved Bank of America. There are two different ways the jury could have found that we met the element with respect to that count. First, the manager from Bank of America said that Bank of America was servicing this loan and that the owner of the loan was Wells Fargo. And I've just explained to you that the jury heard testimony that Wells Fargo was FDIC insured. So that's one path which was not disputed. The second path was that Bank of America, who was servicing the loan, was also insured by the FDIC. And the employee of Bank of America said that Bank of America approved the short sale and Bank of America faced a risk of loss because of their servicing agreement with Wells Fargo, that they could be forced to buy back the loan, for example, if there was fraud that they didn't catch. And so none of that was contested either. With respect to count three, and I'll go through the rest of these a little bit more quickly, U.S. Bank, a bank employee, said that U.S. Bank was insured by the FDIC. U.S. Bank was servicing this mortgage. It was owned by Freddie Mac. U.S. Bank testified, that they faced a risk of loss because of a buyback provision. Again, there was no dispute about any of that at trial. Nobody suggested that we alleged the wrong victim. Counts four and six involved City Mortgage. There was testimony that both of those loans were owned by Citibank North America, which the parties and the witnesses referred to as Citibank, that Citibank was insured by the FDIC, and we alleged City Mortgage as the victim because it was Citibank's mortgage subsidiary. It handled mortgages for Citibank, and there was testimony from which the jury could conclude that City Mortgage was an alter ego or a wholly owned subsidiary of Citibank, which is sufficient, and I will not make the court march through my analysis of that testimony, but it is prevalent in the record. And then I've already talked about GMAC. The last count, count eight, is J.P. Morgan Chase. An employee, assistant vice president from Chase, said that he was going to refer to J.P. Morgan Chase as Chase. He testified that Chase owned this mortgage, approved the short sale, that Chase was insured by the FDIC. None of that testimony was challenged. Indeed, as I said, the defendants wanted to emphasize that these were large and sophisticated banks. I want to briefly address the variance issue that my opposing counsel began with. There was no variance here because the indictment described the exact scheme that we proved at trial. It was an 11-page speaking indictment. It laid out all of the falsehoods and misrepresentations that we ended up proving.
Did it lay out a short sale scheme, or did it lay out just a scheme to submit false HUD statements?
It laid out a short sale scheme in considerable detail. It's in the record at docket number two.
And the false HUD statements were just in furtherance of that scheme?
They were the specific executions of that scheme. But the broader scheme included all of the misrepresentations that Ms. Donahue is complaining about. They included the fact that this scheme was meant to deprive the banks of the higher sales price. All of that is contained in the indictment. And so for the first time, I think, in her reply brief, Ms. Donahoe suggests that all of those paragraphs of the indictment were just surplus and that the only part of the indictment that should stand are the executions. The problem with that argument is I think it's waived because it was raised for the first time in the reply. But also, the defendant certainly had an opportunity to move to strike pages 1 through 7 of our indictment. They did not. And the jury was properly instructed on it. And I would say, finally, There's just no support for the idea that a scheme can be no broader than its specific executions. Indeed, it is commonplace for the government to prove up particular executions that are part of a broader scheme.
Probably if the execution alone had been the subject of the indictment, there would have been a motion for a bill of particulars, right?
Without a doubt there would have been, Your Honor.
So there was essentially larding the indictment up with these facts so as to avoid that difficulty.
We made crystal clear the government's theory and the theory that the government would proceed on at trial. We did that in the indictment to avoid exactly that problem. And we gave the defendants notice, very fair notice of the scheme, and it was properly charged.
And again, reduced to its simplicity, what was the government's theory that presented to the jury?
Yes, Your Honor. The government's theory was that the defendants lied to these banks in order to induce them to agree to short sales. That was the government's theory.
And to what extent did you establish a dollar figure as far as any loss was concerned?
Well, we sought to prove up that dollar figure at sentencing, but the rough dollar figure that we relied on at the trial was the difference between what these defendants bought the house for in the short sale. So in the GMAC example, they buy it for $65,000. They sell it the same day, the same house, for $86,000. And we argued to the jury that the bank was entitled to the benefit of that higher price, which we argued was the market price.
What about the argument that it's two different properties?
Well, it's not. It's the same property. It's a house sitting on 56th Street in Des Moines, Iowa, in Urbandale, I believe, in Iowa. And if it was two different properties, then the bank agreed to a short sale on that house. And that short sale happened on a specific date, the same date that the resale transaction happened. So if the property somehow changed, then in agreeing to the short sale, the bank agreed to a short sale on a different property.
I'm not sure I totally understand the argument, but it's something along the lines of the second sale is free of liens and other potential encumbrances, and that's different than the short sale.
I think that's ultimately an argument about whether the banks actually lost money. The argument is, look, the bank would have had to go into foreclosure proceedings. The defendants were actually doing the banks a favor because in the end the banks didn't want to foreclose on these houses. They wanted to get rid of them in these short sales. I think that's really what the argument is getting at, and that certainly was part of the defense at trial.
I was going to ask, what was the theory of the defense, and now you've just told us, as you point out. Well, in effect, what were they arguing? No harm, no foul?
Well, they didn't say it like that because they didn't want to get up and say, jury, please nullify. But that was one of the arguments. There's no doubt about it. The problem with that argument is that the defendants, we can argue if we want about whether the banks lost money. The district court ultimately found at sentencing that the banks did lose money, but that it was too hard to calculate it with precision. But none of that mattered for purposes of whether the government met the elements here. The defendants still made false statements to these banks to induce them to agree to these short sales. And for defendant Springer, those false statements were the HUD-1 statements that were the executions of the scheme. And I'll just very briefly explain the government's theory about that and what we proved. What the evidence showed was that all of those HUD-1 statements were false, that Mr. Springer knew they were false. All of them said that Nathan Smith or another defendant brought money to the closing. That is what the HUD statement says. That was never true. Mr. Smith never had money to pay for these short sales. He had to wait to resell the house the same day or a couple of days later at a higher price and use that money to fund his first transaction. Every representative from every bank said that if they had known that those HUD ones were false, they would not have approved these short sales. If they had known that Nate Smith was going to resell that property for $20,000 more, or in one case nearly $100,000 more, they would not have approved those short sales. That was our theory. That's bank fraud.
So what is the thing of value that they were deprived of?
Well, there's no question that they were deprived of their security interest in these properties. That's what the mortgage is. It's a lien. It's a security interest. And when the defendants induced the banks to agree to the short sale, they induced the banks to agree to give up that security interest. The jury couldn't possibly have found fraud unless it found that that happened, because that was the only theory on which we proceeded at trial. So security interest is the interest in the mortgage. The property interest is the interest in the mortgage. And that is explicitly how we charge this case. It was fraud to induce banks to agree to short sales. That's how we argued it, and that's what the evidence showed. There was no variance. There was no alternative path to conviction. Unless there are additional questions, I will ask the court to affirm the convictions in this case. In these cases,
theoretically, if the statements were false and the banks lost no money for some reason, was it still a crime?
Yes.
And a falsity is falsity. Morally, I guess it is, but well, okay.
Well, so this court,
I guess we shouldn't worry about theoretical possibilities.
I could agree with the court that that case might not have an enormous amount of jury appeal. You might argue about whether
the
government.
I doubt that you would, that the government, well, who knows what whether the government would try to make an example out of these people or whatever the government does.
I think the law is plain that actual loss and intended loss are not requirements under subsection 1 of 18 U.S.C. 1344.
Probably captured under materiality, right?
Yes, I think that's right. And as we argue to the jury, you don't get to lie to banks to cause them to give up something of value and then say no harm, no foul. Congress has prohibited that. So that is, in fact, explicitly the appeal we made in our closing.
As long as it's a material fact, I guess. Is that the idea?
Yes, and in that case, the banks all testified.
Yeah, they wouldn't have done it if they don't.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you for the argument.
Thank you, Your Honors. I wanted to talk just briefly about the jurisdictional argument. It's not plain error. You can raise it any time, and it doesn't matter whether I raise it on appeal or
what case says it's jurisdictional?
Well, Awood, A-Y-E-W-O-H. U.S. v. Awood, which is a First Circuit case, is the prime one. But
isn't it just an element of the offense, and it's either proven or it's not proven?
No, it's jurisdictional. If you cannot prove it, there is no federal crime.
But jurisdiction's decided at the time it's filed, isn't it?
No, I think jurisdiction has to be proven as a part of a case. You have to prove you have jurisdiction. And I don't think they did prove it, and I think I am able to raise it at any time, and there's not a different...
So if there was no proof of a false statement, which is an element of, let's assume it's an element of...
Well, that's not jurisdictional. What's jurisdictional is that it has to involve a federal interest, and so it's either got to be an FDIC, in this case, FDIC insured.
Jurisdiction.
Yeah.
But not judicial.
Well, but I think you don't have an offense if you haven't proved that it's connected to something that's a federal interest, FDIC.
The government loses, but not because it didn't have jurisdiction, it's because it came up short on the proof.
Well, I think it's because of jurisdiction, okay. But obviously, you know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion.
Mm-hmm. In my mind, what was lacking here?
They didn't prove that the... First of all, they didn't really prove what the false statements were. Okay, so we heard the government say, well, it was they didn't tell the banks that they could could line up these other sales. The first thing you have to look at there is that did any of these entities have a resale restriction? None of them did, except GMAC. There was one that had a paragraph 10 that was Kenyon. Had a paragraph 10 that had something about sale restrictions, don't resell within 30 days in the offer. I don't think as a closing attorney there's any way you would have noticed that. Nobody mentioned it except, you know, in question at time of trial. I don't think that was clearly made an element of the transaction. So the only transaction that had a resale restriction of any kind was GMAC. And as I pointed out before, GMAC was just apparently deciding they wanted this affidavit. And HUD specifically said they had a waiver. They don't care when you resell it. They did have a restriction that they wouldn't finance if it was resold within 90 days, and they waived it during this period of 2010 and 2011. So I don't see, and there's nothing on the HUD that says we have to declare if it's going to be resold contemporaneously or otherwise. So what the government did at the time of trial is say, hey, guys, We're switching theories now. What we really believe is that they lost money because there was a potential that they wouldn't be paid off by the ultimate transaction. So, for example, if the B2C transaction had fallen through, there wouldn't be money going to the bank. And my point there is, hey, there's no loss. First of all, on the first three transactions charged, Jason Springer paid the mortgage off out of his own trust account, not out of any funds received from the B2C transaction. And he was a guarantor of the title. He did a title opinion. There was some testimony there from the title guarantee. He is on the hook anyway, because he said he was going to be able to get clear title through that property. He'd have to pay it regardless. The banks were never at any risk of loss from the fact that they didn't have cash. And then that got all cobbled up. Is it cash or is it a check? Or does it have to be funds directly from the borrower? Could be funds from a mortgage, another mortgage? I mean, it was one of the most ridiculous records I've ever seen if you know how to close a real estate transaction. Doesn't make any sense. Nobody cares whether you have a bag of cash, whether you got a mortgage, whether your Aunt Josie's giving you some money. They don't care. The purpose of the HUD, if you look at it, is just to say we're taking this much money in and we're paying these things out, and at the end of the day, you're going to have clear title. And one other thing I wanted to say about this loss business is if the banks didn't get paid, they didn't have to release their mortgage. There was absolutely no possibility of the banks losing any money related to whether it was a cash or a personal check or whatever. You know, Jason was on the hook for it. He, in fact, paid three of the transactions out of his trust account without getting the funds in from the other.
You make it sound so crystal clear from your standpoint, but if it was that clear, why wasn't this fought out at the district court?
Well, I can't answer it because I didn't try it. Well, I have a theory which I will offer, which is I think most of these attorneys are very intelligent. They know what they're doing, but they never did the nuts and bolts of a real estate transaction. You know, I'm from a small town in northeast Iowa, and I do about 20 of them a year for 40 years. I've done plenty, and, you know, I just don't think they understand the nuts and the bolts of it. There was absolutely no way that they could have lost any money by virtue of how they closed the transactions, whether they were simultaneous or where the money came from. Jason Springer gave a title opinion. That's in the record. He's on the hook.
I thought the theory was more of, you know, not necessarily that they were going to lose money, but they lost the opportunity to make more money, given that there were these willing buyers out there willing to pay more in the short sale situation.
Okay, and, you know, I understood that as well. But what I would answer to that is, what obligation did anybody, my defendants in particular, Mr. Springer and Mr. Makahuniak, have to run to any of these loan servicers, which mostly they were loan servicers rather than mortgage holders, and tell them, hey, there's going to be a resale. Like I say, they didn't have any resale restrictions except for the GMAC. And I don't think they proved jurisdiction in that case, and I don't think they proved that GMAC wouldn't have gone forward. They foreclosed already on the property. They could have done a sheriff sale before deciding to do the short sale. So obviously, and I think from the testimony, they appraised the property and they thought that was a good deal. So, you know, at the end of the day, what false statement got made? And by Mr. Makahuniak, yes, he did know that it was going to be closed. I'm not arguing that, because he was representing the buyer. This is why he got himself involved. He represented the buyer on the B2C sale. And so, you know, his main incentive was to try to avoid having the whole thing fall through for the people that he knew and he was representing. But and I agree that I did waive the argument on appeal regarding the falsity of the affidavit. And the reason that I did was because I have to interpret the facts in the light most favorable to the government. And I didn't feel that the record justified that, but I don't think it matters. I don't think they proved that Mr. Makahuniak made a false statement other than that one affidavit to GMAC, which I think didn't have anything to do with the price of tea in China because it wasn't required by HUD. She testified HUD made the final decision. And if you look at the paperwork, there was a sheet from HUD that said it was okay to go ahead at the price they went ahead at. And there was specific testimony from Martin, we don't care when you resell it. There's no restrictions. So I guess at the end of the day, I think this is a paper tiger. I mean, they're building it up, and they're switching boogeymen from one count to another. They just lumped it all together. For example, I didn't hear them ever explain whether there was resale restrictions or not, except for the GMAC. And there turns out there wasn't. And so what was it that induced or required Mr. Springer or Mr. McAhoonyuk to tell the banks, hey, there's another closing out there? And what difference did it make if it was 1 day, 5 days, 10 days, or whatever later, because there was no sale restriction? I mean, I think we've basically ended up cooking up. We didn't like the fact that they made more money, and we want to punish them. I think that's, at the end of the day, that's the whole case, and I don't think it has any merit, and I wish you would reverse it. Thank you.
Thank you for the argument on both sides. The case is now submitted, and we will take it under consideration.